Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about Tech Tent from our webpage. Go to bbc.com/programs/techtent. Hello and welcome to Tech Tent, the programme that gives you a weekly status update on the tech business. With me this week from the BBC Technology Desk are Leo Kelly, and he edits our tech web pages.
Hey, Rory.
Hi, Leo. And for the first time, Dougal Shaw, who shoots video for these pages.
Hi.
Hi, Dougal.
Hi.
Now, Dougal, I've got to tell you, you've got competition this week. I'm wearing, in a wacky experiment, Google Glass. I'm attempting to live stream the show. You're getting video pictures from my point of view of the show. And if you go to our Twitter account, at BBC Tech Tent, you'll find a link which may, I repeat, may allow you to see as well as hear us. Anyway, let's get on with it. We also have a very special guest in the tent, Dr. Sue Black, a computer scientist at University College London, also a social media campaigner on all sorts of interesting issues. Welcome, Sue Black.
Thank you very much. Hi, Rory.
Well, let's get going. First, the scary story that has set the alarm bells ringing across the tech world for days. Woken you up. That's Heartbleed, a flaw in the vital OpenSSL software which protects data on hundreds of thousands of websites. It sent waves of panic through the IT departments of businesses, big and small, and left consumers pretty unsure how to react. What is it, and what should we do about it? On the line, we're joined by Professor Alan Woodward, a cybersecurity specialist from the University of Surrey, and our Leo Kellyan's been working all hours chasing up the latest leads. First of all, Professor Woodward, a quick explanation from you of what it is and why it matters.
Well, SSL, we might not realise we're using it, but we use it every day. It's when you're trying to have a secure, secret conversation between you and your bank or some online retailer. The beginning of the conversation, there's this secret handshake that goes on, basically saying how you're going to communicate. However, you might not be sending data over that secure link for a while, so there was an extension built to it called Heartbeat. And what that does is you send to the other computer a bucket load of data and say, have you received my bucket load of data? And to prove it has, it sends back the bucket load of data. And when you're sending that bucket load of data, you say, this bucket's got X amount of data in it, but you can lie, it turns out, and it sends the bucket back, but it fills the bucket up with other bits and pieces it just happens to have in its computer memory, which unfortunately can be things like passwords or the very encryption keys that are supposed to be keeping you safe.
Pretty scary. The industry's rushed to patch it. How far have they got with patching?
It's patchy, to use a pun. Some people say they've done it. Some people won't say whether they had a problem in the first place. It's actually very, very difficult for normal consumers to know, A, if someone was affected, and B, whether it's been patched. Because, of course, the advice is, with things like passwords potentially being revealed, change your password. But there's no point in doing that until you know the system's been upgraded.
Leo Kellyan, as I said, you've been chasing this story for 24 hours. We've actually just had breaking news, haven't we, in the last couple of minutes on this very interesting. What's the latest?
Yes, well, the US government has warned that they say hackers are attempting to exploit the bug in targeted attacks by scanning networks to see if they're vulnerable. We reported yesterday that these scans were going on, but at that point it was unclear whether it was malicious parties trying to do this or whether it was people just trying to check whether these sites were safe and then alert the people behind them.
It really raises the stakes, doesn't it, when the US government gets involved? And I think you've got another angle too that you've been chasing.
Well, that's right. We've been looking today at the makers of internet hardware and software, warning that some of their products are vulnerable to the bug as well. And we've been seeing that everything from video conferencing kit, internet phone call software, firewalls and apps that are supposed to let workers be able to get into their companies, to get at the company data securely, that some of those products are affected as well.
Professor Alan Woodward, this is a terrible thing for consumers to deal with. It's bad enough for the industry itself. One of them said to me, one executive at a web firm said to me, I spoke to my security guys, they said, the internet's on fire. Those kind of messages going out to consumers, but not very clear messages from the cybersecurity industry, it strikes me, as to how they react.
No, there's this sort of conundrum where people have said, don't do it, don't change your passwords just yet. You've got to check and see if the system's been upgraded. But it's like the bit that Leo was just talking about, the so-called firmware, the embedded software, which is an even bigger problem. You know, how does the regular user know how to do that? All one can really do is issue relatively simple advice, which is, if it's a reputable business running that site, they should have upgraded it by now. So it makes sense to play safe and change your passwords.
One of the interesting things that struck me is the whole process when one of these vulnerabilities is exposed of who tells who and how soon, because there's a huge the moment of maximum danger, isn't it, when this is first revealed?
Yeah, well, it's quite interesting, actually, because the last few days have seen the UK launch. Most countries now have a computer emergency response team, a CERT, and the UK's now got its own CERT, the UK CERT, and they're the ones that try and issue these warnings to people. But, of course, you've got to try and get the warning out there, but as soon as you do that, you alert the hackers to the fact there's a flaw as well, and they can start exploiting it. And, of course, as Leo was saying, you know, the US government have been saying people are scanning. Well, actually, what we actually don't know is that people scanning using the sites that are already up there to check whether, I don't know, well-known names are vulnerable, or is it hackers scanning those sites to see if they're vulnerable?
Sue Black, you're a computer scientist, but you're not a cybersecurity expert. Have you been as confused as the rest of us about what to do yourself and how to advise friends?
Yeah, I guess so, in a way. I mean, I asked on Facebook earlier because I've got friends who are security experts and they were giving advice, one piece of which was to look at Mashable because they've got an updated spreadsheet of which companies are doing what. So, yeah, we're all a bit in the dark. It's like when new things happen any time, it's new for all of us. And so, you know, we need the experts getting in quickly to advise us.
But, and the experts don't agree, unfortunately. Yeah. A lot more on this on the BBC technology site, www.bbc.com/technology. But let's move on. Last week, we heard from our chief business correspondent, Linda Yu, on how we might not be in a tech stock bubble if you go by the figures. This week, tech stocks have taken an absolute pounding, losing all of their gains so far this year on New York's Nasdaq exchange. There was bad news earlier in the week when Samsung Electronics warned of lower profits, and we'll be talking about Samsung shortly. But here's the question. Is the party over for tech stocks, or will the likes of Facebook, Twitter and Google continue to attract outlandish valuations? I spoke to Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial in New York.
I think the market is beginning to distinguish between companies where valuations really are extreme and companies where, in fact, they're still quite reasonable, which is exactly what you expect to happen after such a sharp sell-off. In 1 month, we were, after all, down 7.3%, which is a dramatic correction. And it's reasonable, I think, given that the entire sector was down, that investors are now picking through and finding opportunity after that big collapse.
What's really struck people here in particular is the valuations at the IPO level, at the arrival on the stock market. We had a food takeaway service launch at over $2 billion with not great revenues a week or so ago. Is that kind of IPO going to be more difficult now?
I think, unfortunately, especially after 2 days with tech stocks up significantly, we're likely to forget that caution, at least for the next year or so. Typically, what happens once retail investors get involved in the U.S., and that really started about a year ago in this cycle, they tend to be less cautious as long as there's upward momentum. And I think upward momentum is going to prevail as long as we have fairly easy policy from the Federal Reserve. Part of the reason we went through this correction is that the Fed is taking some of that easiness off the table. But after all, we still have near zero interest rates here, and that should be enough to encourage investors to continue to chase yield in riskier assets. So I think we will, in fact, see some fairly unbelievable IPOs even after this correction.
Chris Lowe in New York there. You're listening to Tech Tent on the BBC World Service, and we're undergoing an extraordinary experiment. We're streaming live. You can see the link at our Twitter account, at BBC Tech Tent. Now, every day, a new idea which threatens to disrupt a traditional industry seems to come out of San Francisco and Silicon Valley. But this week I heard about what seemed the unlikeliest web business yet. HomeJoy wants to disrupt the home cleaning industry by acting as a middleman between homeowners and cleaners. I thought the web was about disintermediation, cutting out that middle layer. So when Adora Chung, the founder of HomeJoy, popped into the office, I wanted to know what the thinking was behind this online cleaning concept.
My co-founder is Aaron. He's my little brother, and he had a really messy apartment. A typical bachelor pad. His bathroom was the grossest in the world. And he decided he wanted to go find a cleaner. And he ran into two problems. One is to find someone he trusted and he knew would actually know how to clean. You would have to go to an agency, but it was too expensive for him. On the flip side, he could go to an online classified site, but you didn't know, and it's more affordable, but he didn't know who was going to actually show up. And so he decided there was a place for us to actually build something to remove that pain point.
And how has it grown? You've been in operation 18 months. What's been the growth path?
So we started in San Francisco in the United States. It took us 6-7 months to get to 31 cities across the U.S. and Canada. We have over 1,000 cleaners on the platform right now, and our revenues are in well over the millions on a monthly basis.
So you've got over 1,000 cleaners. What's your take of what those cleaners are earning?
In London, we will be charging £13 per hour, and we pay the professional cleaners anywhere from £8 to £9 per hour. And the rest goes towards customer service and marketing.
Certainly from the cleaner's point of view, you're taking a cut of what they could earn. From the customer's point of view, you're probably making it more expensive. It's not clear that this service provides a wonderful new utility for people.
We send someone who is background checked, interviewed in person. They go through a test clean, so we know they know how to clean. And they've maintained high customer satisfaction ratings. And on top of that, we ensure the cleanings itself. And on top of that, you can pay with your credit card online, so you don't have to deal with cash or anything like that. But I think what I'm most passionate about is the community that we're creating amongst the cleaning professionals and the job opportunities that we're unlocking within the home.
Are you convinced then that you are creating more jobs? Because obviously there have been cleaners since forever.
Yeah.
There are people looking for cleaners since forever. What makes you think that you're actually providing extra jobs?
It's a good question. So what we found in the U.S. is that many of our customers have never actually had cleaning before. And so we've kind of created this new market, or expanding the market of cleaning. So yeah, it is an old industry, but we believe we're just unlocking these opportunities that never existed before.
Adora Chung of HomeJoy there. Dr. Sue Black, our special guest, what's your take? Another wacky web idea. It doesn't really seem to add up to me. I don't know what you think.
Oh, well, that's interesting, because I don't think it's wacky at all. So, I mean, we've got Hassle.com here already working in London, offering cleaners at £10 an hour and getting lots of customers. And there's also TaskRabbit have just come over to London in the last few months, I think, and are doing cleaning and things like putting up your IKEA furniture for you for £12 an hour.
It just strikes me that somebody's coming into the middle of a business which works pretty well for customers and cleaners already.
But I think it offers kind of a trusted service. It's like kind of LinkedIn. It can connect you to people that are already being checked out for being trusted. And so you can find a trusted cleaner and the cleaner can find a trusted house to work in.
Right. Well, we'll see how it goes. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Samsung is among the tech companies whose shares have come under pressure lately. In the case of the South Korean firm, because it's admitted that competition is squeezing profits from its high-end smartphones. Well, today, the latest of those phones, the Galaxy S5, goes on sale. I've got one with me right now. It comes with a handy heart monitor, which tells me my current heart rate is 78 beats per minute. It's also water resistant. I can drop it into a jug of water. But how healthy is Samsung faced with competition from Chinese firms like Xiaomi, which, according to one analyst report I read this morning, says makes a phone as good as the Galaxy for half the price? I asked Luke Mansfield, head of innovation in Europe for Samsung, how they can convince phone buyers they're different from the rest.
It seems, I think, if you don't know much about the hardware, to have a waterproof phone where you can take the back off maybe doesn't feel quite so revolutionary. I can tell you on behalf of our engineers, it's really hard. And so what we're doing now is we're packing in those features, which means that all of those things that people love about their smartphones, they can have those things on the beach, they can have those things with their kids without having to worry about their kids covering their phone in jam. Just rinse it under the tap.
Samsung has been making huge profits from smartphones. The market's turned, though, hasn't it? You yourselves have warned of thinner margins, of challenge to profits. The whole landscape's got a lot more difficult for Samsung.
I think it's no secret that, I mean, analysts are predicting that the market's saturated. That a saturated market means that there's no more innovation, and it suggests that there's nothing new we can bring, and we completely disagree with that. So, you know, that's why some of the new features in this phone we think are going to compel people to upgrade their phones to the latest model. Samsung's philosophy is that at every price point we need to have the best phone, and that's what we're working hard towards. And our belief at every level is that if we have the best phone in every segment, then people are prepared to pay a bit more. I think the data shows that.
Where is the stiffest competition coming from now? Is it coming from Apple, your traditional rival, or is it coming from these new Chinese entrants who are producing good phones at much cheaper levels?
I think competition is coming from everywhere. It's always been a fiercely competitive market. I think looking at competition is actually the wrong approach. So we look at our consumers. My team has spent 5 years in people's homes understanding what do they really want, what are they really going to need in the future. And this is a response to that, not a response to the market.
That's Luke Mansfield from Samsung. Dougal Shaw, our video specialist in the tent for the first time. You and I have actually gone and filmed loads of these smartphone launches. Do they all begin to look the same to you as they do to me?
They do a bit, but they say you never forget your first mobile phone launch. And I remember the one in the summer of 2012, the first one I went to, and you were there, and that was the Galaxy S3. And that was amazing razzmatazz and just ridiculous hundreds of people then being shepherded into different rooms and waiting to touch the actual phone itself. And you kind of slowly realise over the time doing this job that they need to create this huge impact and razzmatazz, because a lot of these phones are essentially very, very similar. When you come to filming them, trying to demonstrate them to other people in videos, there's not that much, there's very little to see, really.
That's why we were very keen to pick out the heart rate monitor and the fact that you could dunk it in water, which actually is not a new thing. Other phones can do that. As a cameraman, though, I mean, phones are becoming pretty good cameras, aren't they? Do you ever think, I better throw away my big camera and just start filming on a smartphone?
No, I really do. And I'm seriously a bit worried for my job, because the results you can get from a phone are amazing. And I had to edit something recently where it was a mixture of footage from a smartphone and HD, you know, proper news camera footage. And I was worried, I didn't know which was which, but I was worried in the edit you'd see the difference between the two, and you didn't. It was filmed outside with the natural light, so that kind of helped it. But the quality you can get now is amazing.
Really interesting. Well, let's move on, though, because we've got a lot to pack in still. You're listening to BBC Tech 10 on the BBC World Service. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones. Now, this week has seen ceremonies marking the 20th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda. But in recent years, that country and its somewhat controversial leader, Paul Kagame, have shown huge ambitions to use technology to become a leading African economy. I visited a few years ago and saw some of the work already going on to improve the infrastructure and bring fast broadband to Rwanda. Things have moved on, and now entrepreneurs are starting high-tech businesses in incubators like the K-Lab in Kigali. Giovanni Ntabgoba, who runs K-Lab, told me how it was going.
We have a community of 364 people. The ideas they have range from ICT for agriculture, ICT for education, finance. So they each have different challenges they're trying to solve. We've got one of our members called Aphrodis, who has a startup called Foyo. It's an SMS application that gives diet advice to people with chronic diseases. So if you have, say, diabetes, you can subscribe to his application and you'll be given guidance of what to eat, which exercises to do, which best medical doctor to look for in town. So it's one of the brilliant ones that we have here.
Rwanda has been very ambitious about technology as a driver for the economy, but has it actually got the infrastructure? Is there a population with enough connectivity themselves to provide a market?
Whenever the entrepreneurs that we have here are developing solutions, we're looking at the East African market, which is above 100 million people. the Rwandan government, in a joint venture with a Korean company, has an ambitious plan of having 4G network being launched across the entire nation, 96% coverage in 3 years. So with that, then we'll have the necessary infrastructure at least to connect all Rwandans.
And in terms of the level of optimism amongst Rwandan entrepreneurs, is there really the sort of can-do spirit that is needed? I mean, you've got people in Kenya in particular making a real impression there. Can Rwanda do the same?
Well, in that aspect, of course, it requires a lot. So there's a lot, like, regarding the culture change, where you find maybe the culture is not that aggressive or hungry for technology, but say some of the concepts that we have here in K-Lab is that we should be more open, not just to Rwandans, to everyone. Then when you have people coming from all over the world, then you tend to have that culture developing. So, for example, if you look at the 360 members of K-Lab, we have people from Silicon Valley who are based here, UK. That's the reason we have all sorts of backgrounds, which is a prerequisite for innovation.
That's Giovanni Ntabwoba, who runs the K-Lab in Kigali in Rwanda. Dr. Sue Black, still with us. We're obviously hearing about new skills coming to Rwanda, new tech skills. You've been a great campaigner for tech skills amongst young people in this country, in the UK, but also globally for women in technology. How do you think that whole fight is going?
Absolutely. Well, I can really feel things are changing at the moment. I mean, the example of Rwanda, the Rwandan government is more than 50% women, which I think is probably helping with all the exciting things that are happening there. And I think that women in tech are fundamental. The more women we get into tech, the better it's going to be. So that's why I've started a program called Tech Mums. We want to get mums excited about technology across the world. But also, I think the whole tech area, people are getting more getting to grips with it and thinking that tech's an exciting thing rather than, you know, possibly a negative connotations that we had before. So, for example, we've got more kids going into computer science in universities these days too.
And as we near the end of the show, let's return to our first story about Heartbleed, the story of the week. What I'm slightly concerned about is what we and the tech world is telling consumers. Leo Kellyan, you've been very close to this. Do you think millions of people out there are now getting a clear view of what they need to do about their own computers, about their own passwords?
Well, I think the message is going out to people that they need to reset their that they may need to reset their passwords. Here's the word "may" again. When certain services are fixed, we talked before, it's very difficult for them to go to a central place and get all that information. We talked about Mashable being one resource. We've done it here. The issue, though, is that a lot of those sites are country-specific.
OK, unfortunately, we're running out of time. Thanks to our guest, Dr. Sue Black, to Leo Kellyan and to Dougal Shaw. And join us in the Tech Tent next time.